The Hartford Daily Courant, Sunday, September 15th, 1918. Sons of Mr. and Mrs. J.W. North of Rockville, in service. One, honorably discharged. Mr. and Mrs. Joseph North of Rockville have four sons in the service of Uncle Sam, and the fifth son has been honorably discharged because of injuries received in the service. Mr. and Mrs. North were born in Claytonville, New York, but have been living in Rockville a number of years. There are five sons and two daughters in the family, and the four oldest sons are in the service, with three of them with the American Expeditionary Forces in France, and one training in this country. Henry T. North, 31 years old, is now connected with Company C, 321 Field Signal Battalion, located at Camp Alford Vale, Little Silver, New Jersey. He was quartermaster sergeant in Old Company C when that company was located in Rockville. He went to the Mexican border with the 1st Connecticut Signal Corps. He was called out a year last March when the troops were mobilized, but was discharged on account of dependents. On August 1, 1918, he voluntarily enlisted in the Signal Corps and was sent to Camp Alford Vale, New Jersey. He was transferred to Camp Meade, Maryland, and has been transferred back to Camp Alford Vale. William J. North, the second brother, 28 years old, joined the Merchant Marine Service last June in Boston. He was sent to Camp Upton and was transferred to Camp Meade, Maryland. He is connected with the 315th Infantry Machine Gun Company, and at present time he is with the American Expeditionary Force in France. Francis R. North, the third brother, is 25 years old. He volunteered for special service in July and was sent to Franklin Union Institute in Boston. After 6 weeks training as an automobile mechanic, he was sent to France with the American Expeditionary Force. He is connected with Company C, 315th Automobile Truck Battalion. Patrick North, 21 years, is the fourth brother in the service. He is connected with Company A, 326th Field Signal Battalion of the American Expeditionary Force. He enlisted in the United States Navy in 1912 and has seen service at Veracruz. He was honorably discharged in 1915. He enlisted for service with the American troops at the Mexican border in 1916. On July 15, 1917, he was called to the colors and his company was sent to Niantic, and after a stay of a few months, the company left for Spartanburg, South Carolina, and went to France from that camp. A fifth brother, Charles S. North, 22 years, has received an honorable discharge from service because of injuries he received at the Mexican border. He enlisted April 15, 1916, and was sent to Niantic with Company A, 1st Infantry, on July 18th for training. His company left for the Mexican border on June 28th and was stationed at Nogales, Arizona. While working about the camp in a thunder shower, he was struck by lightning on July 27th. He was sent home on 3 months furlough, after which he was ordered to the Walter Reed Hospital in Washington for an examination and was honorably discharged. He again entered the service when war was declared on March 15, 1917, and was sent to Waterbury and from there to Danbury. He was discharged at Danbury on April 15th. Our next article is A Former Current Man Tells of Thrilling July Days Somewhere in France. Charles A. Plummer of Southington describes scenes of eventful period when Allies were driving Germans towards Kaiserland, 2nd Division did its bit. The following letter has been received by Dr. and Mrs. Paul Plummer of South Main Street, Southington, from their son, Charles A. Plummer, who was in the Quartermaster Corps in France. Mr. Plummer was a former member of the city staff of the Courant, which place he left last summer to enlist. Somewhere in France, August 6, 1918. Dear mother, father, and all, it seems like ages since I received my last mail. That was 2 weeks ago, and then it was more than a month old. As you all probably know, the 2nd Division has been doing some work, and has been for the last 3 months. The 1st and 2nd Divisions are Uncle Sam's shock troops, and they sure did shock Heine on July 18th. But I don't believe we'll do much more shocking for some time. So few of the old bunch are left that we are going back for more training of the kind we had last winter and spring. Eventful July days. I'll never forget those 5 days of July so long as I live, as hell was never like those days, and I never want their sequel, Blood and Brains, to express it as the old Collinsville fire chief did, does not describe the really terrible scenes. Dead men were more numerous up around Long Point and Sasson than the flies on a dead horse. Not only men, but horses, too. The roads were lined with dead, dying, and wounded. It seemed impossible to evacuate the wounded and bury the dead. They used all the German prisoners and the non-combatants during those days to bury the German and Allied dead. The thousands of prisoners were made to work, carrying the wounded and to do stevedore work at advanced rations and munitions dumps. The night before the attack, which began by the opening of that terrific barrage, we had arrived from Chateau Thierry and Montreux-Lyon sector. We also made a name for ourselves. We proceeded with 58,000 rations. A ration is 3 meals for one man for one day, right up to the third line, which is pretty well advanced. We were at the top of a steep hill, right in front of the artillery, which had been taking risky steps by advancing during the previous 2 or 3 days. We parked our 75 3-ton Packards at the top of this young mountain in the middle of the famous Bois de Villers-Cotterêts, the Villers-Cotterêts Woods. Traffic was blocked. It was growing dark. It started to pour, but it was necessary to get munitions, etc., further up the line. There was a terrible feeling of anxiety, for what we guessed was going to happen would not take place. We could not get off the highway as the trucks would sink hub deep in the soft mud. Consequently, the French, Moroccans, and the American artillerymen drove through the mire. The munitions got there and so did the Allies, but I tell you, it was some work. The draft animals seemed to know that they must put forth their utmost effort and strength, and they did. The mules pulled like windlasses, and every man put his shoulder to the wheel and helped. The traffic continues throughout the night. Not a man could see another straight. It was so dark, and when the lightning flared, or occasionally flashes from guns lit up the scene, there were weird faces one saw, marked by lines of determination and belief that they were God's free men, sent to accomplish His will. While all this was going on, the veteran French Zouaves and Moroccans and Americans marched by, if one could call it marching. Rather, they stumbled and waded through the murky ditches at the roadside. It seemed as though several thousand passed every hour, but the parade never ceased that night. About 2 o'clock in the morning, I was awakened from my sleep to watch the bread trucks by the fire of the heavy artillery which we had passed the previous afternoon while going out of Villers-Cotterêts. The thunder had also done its bit to wake me up. The rain was pouring down in torrents. I sure did feel sorry for those doughboys who did not seem to mind it a bit. The column halted for a minute or two. When the order came down the line, throw away all packs and unnecessary equipment and double time ahead. And it was not a minute after the command was given that the column was on the run, most of the soldiers in shirt sleeves with their rifles unslung, ready for action. All had extra bandoliers of the ammunition, which seemed their only baggage. The gas masks, of course, were at alert position. It is not necessary for me to tell you what happened. It did not happen right at that time, but it has happened since we moved up here. Soissons is recaptured, Chateau Thierry is once more France's land, and the Germans have been sorely defeated. Their center push formation has been thrown back, and Paris is safe. We did not do a whole lot, but we did our bit, and the boys of the 2nd Division know it and are proud of it. I am enclosing a copy of the orders for your information, which refers to our fight at Chateau Thierry, where the Marines did their work in the Bois de Bleu and the 10th Infantry took Vaux. Our casualties, including wounded, were large. Well, I think that I will close for tonight, and I hope that this finds you all in good spirits. Your son and brother, Ted. Our next article, Veterans and Promising Candidates in Every Field. The opening of the Hartford High School last Monday also meant the opening of the athletic season for 1918 to 1919. The football squad has been practicing last week and looks promising, and in the basketball squad will be found a number of veterans. The only two who will be missing will be Captain Nordlin and Babe Getz. Prospects also loom up rosy, baseball, hockey, tennis, and track. When the call is sounded for candidates for the various teams, many veterans and experienced players will respond and will be prepared to hold down the positions they have held for the past few years. The enthusiasm shown by the majority of the pupils at the school and all sporting events makes one believe that this branch of school life is becoming more popular every year. The teams are handled in the best of ways and are under the care of the pick of the school, who are chosen by the faculty nominated by 25 members of the Athletic Association, and it's finally elected by the whole school. The captains are chosen, as before, by the members with whom they play. Below is a review of the captains, managers, and players who will take care of the sports of the HPHS for the following year. Football. The football squad has been busy practicing during the past week, and although the season is young, some fine material has shown up. Sam Sussman was elected at the close of last season the captain of the team. He began his football career in the grammar school from which he entered high school, and under able coaching, made the freshman team. The following year, Sussman went out for the school team, and the early part of his sophomore year was devoted to practice. Since that time, Sussman has been holding down a regular berth with the team. After showing his wonderful ability in all last year's games, Sussman, who was often acting captain, was finally elected captain. Rube Cohen was elected to the post of manager. Cohen is also a player of the game and an all-around man. He is arranging a schedule and to date has arranged but one game with New Britain to be played in Hartford on November 9th. Basketball. Reed Leyland, the lad who has been with this team for a number of years and is one of the five veterans, will hold down the position of captain for the following year. With a fine combination of veterans like Sam Sussman, Rube Cohen, Barrows, and Clarkin, it is expected that this team will be a winner. The manager this year falls to Eddie Sussman. Eddie was last year's assistant and practically held down the manager's position, for Coogan, last year's manager, was sick at the end of the year and was unable to take care of the team. Baseball. The captaincy of baseball this year went to Reuben Cohen, another all-around man. He has been with the team now for 2 years. William Coughlin, commonly known as Bill, will take care of the financial side of the game this year. Track. Thurston Rowley will pilot the track team for the coming year. Captain Rowley is very fortunate in having under his care a raft of good material composed of veterans who have had 1 and 2 and even 3 years with the track team. The team has lost very few men in the graduating class. Among the quarter-mile men, the team has Vennett, McNiff, and Rowski. The dash and jump men are Hartsmark, Lyley, Burke, and Adigo. Bill Burke will take care of the financial and schedule side of the game. Burke was last year's assistant and is himself a track man. Golf. The golf team has a fine outlook for the coming season, numbering among its men Harold Deschamps, who won the Committee Cup at Goodwin Park last month, also Percy Griffith, who does the course in 79. He will also be manager for the coming year. Two other men on the team are Gorman, of 2 years' experience, and Hartsmark. As yet, no captain has been chosen for the coming season, But with trials coming up, it will probably soon be known who will be captain. Tennis. Sam Snyder, who won the City Amateur Tennis Championship, will captain the high school team. Richard Leinhard, one of the veterans and a football man, will be Snyder's partner. To accompany them, they will have Robert Hoskins and Babe Hartsmark. Hoskins was also elected to be manager of the team. Athletic Association. Besides the many offices he already holds, Sam Sussman is president of the Athletic Association. The following are the remaining officers: Vice President William Gillette, Secretary Red Leyland, Treasurer Samuel A. Albert of the faculty. High School Lads in the Football Mill. The Hartford High School football squad, for the third time this week, appeared on the field at Elizabeth Park for practice. With the passing of each day's practice, the squad is beginning to thin out, and the better material is being left for Coach Gardner, who made his initial appearance yesterday. Although Coach Gardner did not put in his appearance yesterday, Mr. Fox was on hand and put the team through its preliminary practice. The best choice for the quarterback position, as seen from yesterday's practice, is Captain Sussman, who has now held down that position for 2 years. For center, there are still two opponents in Borg and Dunn, the latter a brother of Captain Joe Dunn, last year's captain of the team. The former has already played with the team, having been present at a few games at the beginning of last year's football season, and of the latter, although a newcomer, is showing pep and vim. For the line of the other men who are out for position on the team are Kane, Borg, Dodge, Newton, Clarkin, Coughlin, and Manning. For positions on the backfield, there are Captain Sussman, Barrows, Eddie Sussman, Mag Wright, Newton, Cohen, and Leland. Our next article, Young Officers Thrill Fascinated Onlookers with Their Mastery. Before an enthusiastic crowd of nearly 35,000 people at Goodwin Park yesterday afternoon, three young aviators of the 48th Squadron, United States Army Signal Corps, demonstrated their ability to perform in the air many stunts that some acrobats would not have attempted on land, and incidentally lent great assistance in the war-saving stamp drive that was brought to a climax in Hartford yesterday. It was Hartford's first great ovation to any group of aviators, and during the full hour that the officers were in the air, the mammoth crowd stared aghast in admiration at what was formerly black art, even to the pioneer aviators themselves. Golf was indeed a minor affair, and the links, from the first to the ninth holes, were roped off with more than 200 automobiles parked against the ring, with their occupants standing on the running boards, and the rest of the crowd with necks craned far back in order to carefully watch every movement of the airmen. It was a night once common at Hendon Field, England, at Toronto, or at the Texas Aviation Field. The preliminary excitement started when the three planes driven by Second Lieutenant J.W. Frost, S.W. Torney, and G. Dorsey, who left their station at Mineola yesterday morning at about 8:30 o'clock and arrived in Hartford shortly before noon and were seen circling over the city. Traffic stopped in the streets. Trolley cars and jitneys passed, and people stared upward at the cries, "They are there! Aren't they wonderful?" One of the machines was headed for the Traveler's Tower, and the owners seriously thought that the work of months would be knocked away by a single blow when a skillful airman swerved his plane and spiraled upward within a few rods of the building. The crowd gasped in delight. The trip from New Haven to Hartford was made in 25 minutes. The three lieutenants had quite a thrilling time at the Yale Bowl, flying above it and volplaning and eventually landing in the bowl itself. At Goodwin Park, the current reporter was fortunate in interviewing the officers. All three were splendid types of young college men, trained perfectly for their task and as fearless in the air as when casually sitting beside their machines smoking cigarettes. On the way up to Hartford, said Lieutenant Frost, who, by the way, was the cleverest airman of the three, we successfully bombed South Norwalk, Westport, and Bridgeport. Not with hand grenades of the poisonous kind, of the one that Bosch used, but with war savings literature, which we hope will do some good. We had to land for a moment in Milford because the valves on Lieutenant Dorsey's plane went bad, although the screw remained intact. Having repaired that, we went on through New Haven, stopping at the Yale Bowl and making Hartford about 2:25. Lieutenant Frost was the one who made the sensational loop-the-loop around the Traveler's Tower and later did a nosedive inside Charter Oak Park. He and Lieutenant Dorsey landed at Goodwin Park at 1 o'clock and then were taken to the University Club for dinner. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Torney had landed in Colts Meadow, one of the finest landing spots he had ever seen. Later in the afternoon, the crowd kept coming to Goodwin Park in special cars and by automobile. The monotony of waiting was broken by the music furnished by Hatch's band and the natural curiosity which everybody had in looking at the great artificial birds marked with the red, white, and blue bullseye. Each plane bore the name of the pilot on the underside and the soubrettes, Jax, Jim, and Stu, printed on one end, these being the nicknames of the aviators. It was after 3 o'clock, and the fourth plane, which was supposed to complete the flotilla, had not yet appeared. It was later learned that Lieutenant M.G. Cleary, who is ordinarily in command of the three planes driven by the other three officers, was sick when the trio left Mineola yesterday, and consequently had given up the trip. In addition to the three officers, there was a master signal electrician for each ship, these being Sergeant Still, Bernstein, and Higgins, who also are from the 48th Squadron, United States Signal Corps. At about 3:30, the aviators appeared and began donning their leather coats and buttoning up the fur-lined caps with the goggles held around them. Each man looked appraising, head up at the sky, as if in judgment of the clouds that were quite thick at the time, but not hanging very low. One of the officers said that they would probably not exceed 1,500 or 2,000 feet in altitude, as they were under orders not to do so. They were even obliged to refuse the request of Mayor Kinsella and the representatives of the Hartford newspapers to go up with them in short flights. At the suggestion from one of the officers that they get in the air, the other two agreed, and after cries of contact and reverse from pilot to electrician and the test of the great screws, Lieutenant Torney got underway and sped rapidly down the fair green toward the clubhouse. He seemed to have a bit of difficulty in getting up enough speed at first and had to go a little further than he expected. Then he turned the wheels of his machine, being still on the ground, and, amid a burst of applause from the crowd, began to soar, rising to a height of about 1,000 feet. He was followed in close succession by the other officers in turn, each going through the same formula in getting underway. The crowd settled back to watch, while the giant engines were noisily whirring overhead, and the pilots were testing the altitude. They were like three black mammoth birds as they soared higher and higher. Suddenly, at the arm signal given by the acting commander, the three planes formed company front and dressed in a perfect line back over the links. Next came squads tight in perfect precision, and then the three planes separated and formed a triangle in the air. The well-known loop-the-loop, which aviators say is the easiest of all air stunts, came next. And then, as if not satisfied with the common plane trick, the commanding pilot signaled for a tailspin. Immediately, the three planes spread apart and revolved over and over upward, the chief movement seeming to come from the tail of the machine. Lieutenant Frost did with ease many of the tricks in the clever aviator's bag, including the reversement, flying on his side with engine reverse, the vertical reverse, and the whip stall. The sensation of the afternoon came when Frost side-slooped down towards the crowd and seemed about to smash into the spectators. His machine was going sideways, circling a bit, and continually coming near the ground. But with a deft upward plunge, he soared away again, and the crowd breathed easier. The echelon, much used in aviation drills, was another very pretty spectacle. The three flying machines so close together, side by side, that the wing of one seemed almost to overlap the wing of the next. "My, but this is a beautiful chance to give the beggars hell," claimed Captain Cable, late of the Royal Flyer Corps, as he watched the aviators. And so it seemed, for one could readily imagine the tricks which were used for the amusement of the crowd being utilized over German trenches, with machine guns spitting fire from the sky in answer to the anti-aircraft guns. Captain Cable has had his chance at giving them hell, for he was shot down in France last Thanksgiving and very nearly lost his life when he and his plane smashed to the ground. The Tommies rushed out and brought him back to the rear of the lines, half dead. After a full hour in the air, the three planes landed again, and the crowd was universal in its opinion that it was the greatest show of the sort that Hartford had seen for years. The three officers then made a brief trip over to Wethersfield, New Britain, Bristol, and Waterbury, and returned to Hartford last night in time to be the guests of the special box party at Parsons Theater, arranged through the War Savings Committee of Hartford. About 300 women under Father M.P. Barry were busy at Goodwin Park throughout the afternoon selling war savings stamps and slips of paper upon which were written, "We are doing our bit to fly to victory. Are you doing yours? Buy war saving stamps," were dropped into the crowd by the airmen. Two companies of the Connecticut State Guard, under Major Frank E. Shea with Company C, commanded by Captain P.J. Cosgrove in the 3rd Separate Company, commanded by Captain G.P. Hurd, were of great assistance to the police force under Captain John F. Butler in managing the enormous crowd. Much credit is also due to Superintendent of Parks, George A. Parker, and S. Wales Dixon for the arrangements at Goodwin Park for the occasion.